You're listening to Radio Freethinker, episode 64.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.
And welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don, your philosopher and political scientist.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist.
This is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC.
Rob, I thought I'd throw you off a little there without saying anything.
Where's your second joke?
he left us hanging. Well, gentlemen, how's your long weekend been?
Well, not really long for me. It always seems so short. Work to do here, there, and everywhere. Yourself?
Oh, it was great. I spent my time thankful that Canada is actually a monarchy.
Really?
No, I didn't. I was very disappointed.
You know, I'm curious, how come it's Queen Victoria today and not Queen Elizabeth? Because if you're proud of our monarchy, it should be Queen Elizabeth the second today.
Well, maybe she'll have her day in the future.
Actually, for a couple of minutes, I watched the Victoria Day Parade on TV, which goes on the island. It was really disappointing.
I'm not surprised.
I got blocked by one in Fort Langley. That was kind of annoying.
Interesting.
They must have known you were an anti-monarchist.
Well, we have a great show today. We're going to be talking about all kinds of fantastic stuff, including monsters, sunscreen, and is artificial life a breakthrough or not? But before we get to that, we have some sad news to report. One of the founding fathers of the skeptical movement, Martin Gardner, passed away on Saturday the 22nd of May. He was 95 years old. Martin was one of the founding members of PsyCop, along with people like Carl Sagan, Isaac Asimov, Paul Kurtz, and James Randi. And he wrote Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science, which was first published in 1952. He was a skeptic before there was a skeptical movement. And it still stands as one of the best pieces of literature that explains what it means to be a skeptic today.
That book pretty much laid out the foundation for the modern skeptical mindset. It takes a sort of historic view about how people come to believe in things and explanations of why they're, you know, the beliefs are incorrect based on actual evidence, and sort of taking a poking fun approach at it, you know, very learned, full of pithy quotes.
He was well known for his ability to make a complicated subject actually very fun and exciting. In fact, one of his probably most famous contributions is he was a popularizer of math, and he had a column in Scientific America called Mathematical Games, which he wrote from 56 to 81. Very popular. And I know that personally for me, and like a lot of other people, he'll be missed for his column in Skeptical Inquirer called Notes of a Fringe Watcher. He recently wrote on subjects as diverse as Bill Maher, Bobby Fischer, and New Age guru James Arthur Ray.
I know that personally I would not have become the person who I am if it wasn't for reading Martin Gardner as a teenager in high school. I read Fads and Fallacies, and I read his two collections of mathematical puzzles, Aha, Gotcha, and, you know, they set me off into the sort of geeky nerd that I am today, with an interest in explaining the world in a way that people understand.
Now I feel horrible that I haven't read any of these things. I'll have to do that at some point.
Well, I mean, there's so many books and articles and things to read in the skeptical literature that it's impossible to get to all of them. But I think it's just great that there's this huge, you know, mound of literature that, you know, you can spend your life going through and learning, and it's great. So it's sad that he's gone, but he left us an amazing legacy to enjoy and learn from. So
I think it's important, too, to point out, I mean, one of the things you get from this is that skepticism is something you need to work at all the time. I mean, it's not like one battle you win and then it's all over, right? I mean, he's been fighting this for a long time, and he's not the first skeptic, although you guys idolize him as one, but that's good.
Well, he's one of the first of the modern era.
Exactly. But, I mean, it just shows, you know, now that we've lost one soldier in the fight for reason, you know, we all have to be just that much more vigilant and that more active to go out there and to promote the things that are good, important to us. Skepticism, reason, looking at things with an eye to what could also be going on here.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of things that people might not know about Martin Gardner that I thought might be interesting to discuss on the show. One of them, of personal interest to me, obviously, but a lot of skeptics, through their various travels, find that they develop an interest in magic. And Martin Gardner actually wrote the Encyclopedia of Impromptu Magic, this quite large tome, which you can find in, you know, as a Dover reprint, that includes a lot of different tricks, and a couple of them that he discovered when he was investigating psychics. And actually, a popular magic book publisher, Carl Fulves, published a book by Martin Gardner under a pseudonym in which he exposes the false mediums and psychics and the methods they use to accomplish their deeds.
And I think in honor of that, Rob has offered to do a magic trick right here, right now. He's going to turn himself invisible. Okay, so y'all are just going to have to watch this. Okay, Rob, do your trick.
Yup.
Holy crap, where did he go? He's disappeared. Oh, there, he's back again. Wow, what a fantastic... You know, if only you guys were here in the audience, you would have been so amazed at that.
And Daniel may find that his wallet has also disappeared.
He checks.
I still have it.
Something else to note about Martin Gardner that fewer people might know about is that he was actually a deist. He was a deist. He believed that there was an unseen force governing the laws of the universe, and he also believed in an afterlife.
Interesting. Which I think goes to show that, you know, skeptics are not necessarily atheists, although we can be. And there's a wide range of, you know, slots that you can fit into if you're a skeptic. You don't necessarily have to be, I hate religion, although some people do. But, you know, you can also be a practicing religious person.
I thought technically a deist was God created everything in the beginning and then he went off on vacation somewhere. So he's not actually actively involved in the life every day.
Yeah, he had a belief in a higher power that was tempered by evidence that showed very strongly that if there was someone or something, it doesn't really have much to do with running things day to day.
No one's perfect.
Well, speaking of getting out there and doing skeptical things, did you guys hear about the monster that was discovered in Northern Ontario recently?
I did. I saw some pictures, and they were pretty creepy.
Exactly. So, for our listeners, a monster, quote-unquote, was discovered in Northern Ontario, or at least so some say. In a remote village some 100 kilometers south of Hudson Bay, two nurses were walking along Big Trout Lake with their dog, caught the scent of something, and pulled this strange creature out of the lake. They took some pictures of this strange thing, and it's described as being furry and bald-faced, some 30 centimeters long, and a rat-like tail. Clearly a monster.
Well, I think the local natives have a story about just such a monster, and does anyone remember what it was called? It's something really difficult to pronounce.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a moment. I think it's interesting. I pulled a quote from the article I was reading, and I found this quite humorous. So here it is. Its strange appearance has led to speculation that it may be the mythical Ogopogo, the Chupacabra, or some other marine monster like the Loch Ness Monster. Others have pointed out that it could be a waterlogged bear cub or otter. And it's like they jump to the Ogopogo first. It's already been established that thing lives in BC.
Isn't it a little small to be the Ogopogo?
That's another thing, right?
And the furry tail?
I think there's ever been any reports of Ogopogo being furry or having a rat tail.
Yeah.
Or being 30 centimeters.
Or as Ethan mentioned, living outside of BC.
Exactly.
It's the baby Ogopogo that transferred itself from BC over the Rockies.
There's an underground river.
By secret underground rivers.
That it swam through, yeah. Because they all connect underneath.
That makes sense.
Right. What's great about this story is that if you look at the Globe and Mail article, it mentions pictures. And if you click on the link for the pictures, it leads you to two pictures which are labeled, and I quote, airport terminal and summer scenery cookout. I'm like, there's no monster in these pictures. Which, I don't know, it's very interesting.
I'm surprised in their list of things that it could have been, they didn't mention a Norwegian traffic cop or a 14th century brass plate of abagubu.
Yeah, and...
I mean, it seems like they were just
more likely
crap
to
out of
that
air.
than the Ogopogo or the Chupacabra. A lot of the residents of Big Trout Lake are of the OG Cree community, which is about 1,200 native people there. And it could be that this creature, as Rob mentioned, is a rare local legend, which I think is pronounced the Oma Jinkakos, which roughly translates to ugly one, which led me to wonder, now, did they really ask these people, or did they just like Wikipedia this and go, well, they have an old legend for some crazy monster. Let's just assume that that's what this is.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure whether they talked to any of the people in the community and asked them what they thought it was.
Yeah.
And not to spoil it for you, but it's not actually a monster.
Actually, no. and I doubt the locals would have been really all that annoyed once the story came out, because you'd be getting a lot of people out there. I don't suspect they get a lot of tourist dollars. Well, they get some. I guess they got an airport in the camping area.
So. Well, the airport didn't look too... It was like one building with like a road and... I don't know. Like what Rob mentioned, I think this is some kind of otter or muskrat or something that was, you know, died and fell in the water.
According to the article I saw just this morning, someone identified it as a decaying American mink.
Well, there you go.
What the heck's an American mink doing in Canada?
I wonder if he had his passport.
It swam through the tunnels.
But no, it's funny, because, I mean, this isn't the first time this sort of thing has happened, right? I mean, these kind of carcasses have shown up all across the world, and automatically people jump to some really weird, bizarre analogy. Or it could be a raccoon or something. You know, it's like, I don't know.
And it always turns out to be some sort of, you know, shaved, decaying mammal.
Yeah. Well, there was a case of this not too long ago, like 2 years ago, off... coast of New York or something.
Yeah,
waterlogged thing washed up on shore, and they thought
people
it was...
were freaking out. And
yeah,
I just remembered another one recently. I think it was somewhere in Europe, maybe Spain or something like that. And there was the story of like children beating it, you know, because they were afraid of it and thought it was trying to attack them.
Oh, it's a monster, get it.
Although you really need kids to, you know, be afraid of something, to poke a stick at something weird and ugly. Like, ooh, ick.
Yeah. Well, why don't we take a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Well, we're going to do a bit of follow-up on a story that we talked about a few weeks ago, and that is the Texas School Board, which, as I put it, are putting garbage in their history books.
Or the Texas School Board Massacre.
Exactly. So it turns out that some states are just not going to sit still for this. California is actually going to make laws to prevent the Texas textbooks from popping up in their state. So we talked about this on a previous episode. We mentioned how Texas is taking some drastic actions, for example, talking less about Thomas Jefferson because he's just not that important, talking less about the separation of church and state, talking about how McCarthyism...
Because that is a liberal lie.
Exactly. That McCarthyism is actually not that bad.
Well, and most notably, from what I remember, replacing all mentions of the slave trade with something they called the
Atlantic Triangular Trade.
They originally were going to do that, but they backed down on that one because they're reasonable people.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to point out there's a couple good things in there. Factual like things.
Like Thomas Jefferson.
Well, Thomas Jefferson, and you know, now that part's stupid to think about, but like talking about the fact that currency has been devalued 95% since 1914, I think, but yes, it's mostly garbage.
And right. Presumably kids in a history class don't really need to know that.
Maybe for like an econ class.
In high school class.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, the long and short of this is that California has decided they're not going to tolerate this. So they've tabled a new bill in the state Senate by Senator Leland Lee, who seeks to ensure that none of the Texas standards are going to be allowed in California in any fashion. Under Yee's bill, which is SB 1451, for those of you keeping notes at home, the California Board of Education would be required to look out for any of the Texas content and report it to the Secretary of Education, which is interesting. As I'm sure most of our listeners know, Texas and California are the two largest states in the United States.
They had the largest number of votes in elections.
Right. And also, they have a largest number of students. So whatever these two states decide generally will be the course that the rest of the states get in their textbooks.
So head-to-head, California versus Texas.
Exactly.
So if you're an employer out there and you have a choice between hiring someone from California or Texas, you can skeptically vote by hiring the California over the Texan.
Yes. Well, not to say that Californians are any more skeptical than Texans, but I think it is kind of interesting that you are seeing a bit of a backlash for the sort of rabid... What do the creationists call it? The you know, freedom to teach crap to students.
I'm not sure that's exactly what they call it.
They called something similar. I don't know. But it's nice to see that some people are actually saying, no, this is ridiculous. We don't want our standards of education to drop even further than they already have.
If I may speculate, something else may be at work here, namely that recently California passed a bill or something that basically allows their schooling system to use free open source textbooks rather than paying for textbooks. So this, you know, while academic integrity is probably part of the goal, something else that might be under consideration here is that they don't want to pay that much for textbooks that people don't want.
Exactly. And to add to that, textbooks are notoriously bad anyway, especially history textbooks are usually just taken, like, you know, the previous textbooks and they've added a few pictures to it and they wrap it up in a pretty package and sell it at an overinflated price to students and the school board.
We're not that we're bitter about our experiences here at UBC or anything.
There is, just to put a sour note in this, of course, all it says is that they're going to review.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, I mean, depending on which particular bureaucrat or politicians involved may or may not actually say, well, I think Atlantic Triangular Trade was a great name to call that.
Yeah.
Just to pick one that we don't have to worry about actually coming up.
Well, that sort of brings me to why I dislike California's decision almost as much as I dislike Texas's. I think just this idea that a select group of people high up should decide, like, what everyone is learning over huge states is just, it seems ridiculous to me and totally, totally not good in any way.
Well, again, part of this is the capitalist marketing system. Sorry, no, it's bulk in numbers, right? I mean, it's not that California or Texas in themselves dictate what every other state will do. It's just because so many books are printed for them, it's cheaper for them to throw in an extra million copies, and that will cover Rhode Island as well, who has nowhere near enough to cover the cost of publishing their own particular book.
And this is why I think California's decision to go with the free open source online textbooks is so significant, because it means that districts can basically choose their own textbooks if they want to.
Exactly.
Well, now that we're all talking about different things, maybe we should move on to our next topic.
Well, interesting enough, Rob is going to be talking about Copernicus.
Yes.
What's new with Copernicus?
Bring it to the Polish guy to talk about Copernicus.
Is he spitting in his grave?
Actually, he was spun out of his grave recently because Copernicus has been reburied in a state-sponsored Catholic funeral from his original unmarked grave to a real grave that commemorates his life and work with a granite headstone that has his heliocentric model of the solar system on it.
How do we know he didn't want to be in an unmarked grave?
Well, the story behind this is that Copernicus, for those of you who don't know, was the person who first proposed the heliocentric theory of the solar system, that Earth goes around the sun, rather than the way the church mandated at the time, that everything was Earth-centric, that the sun and everything else went around the Earth. So a lot of people think that he was branded a heretic as a result, and that he might have been buried in a pauper's grave. No one knew where he was buried for quite a long time, and they assumed it was because he was deemed a heretic and was given, you know, an unmarked grave. Actually, Copernicus worked as a church canon and doctor in the parish of the church in Frumbork in northern Poland. And so he published his work on the revolution of the heavens, or I forget the full name, but it wasn't really well known until after his death, and it wasn't considered heretical until after his death. I mean, he was making these observations and doing calculations before the telescope had been invented.
Wasn't that actually one of the big issues, is that when Copernicus came up with his theory and his models, it was deemed as sort of a mathematical convenience. This isn't really the way it is. It's just, if we pretend it's like this, then all the holy days fall on the right date and all that. And it was only when Galileo pointed his thing to the sky and everyone said, wait a minute, maybe this is real and just not a mathematical fiction.
I'm not sure about that, but the point is that no one really cared about it until after he died. So when he died, he was buried like every other church canon underneath the cathedral in an unmarked grave. And years and years later, it's nearly almost 450 or so years after his death, the church, based on some DNA testing of some bones they found underneath the cathedral, and comparing it with one of Copernicus' hairs that they found in a book he owned, they confirmed that it was indeed Copernicus, and also a facial reconstruction from the skull confirmed that it was Copernicus based on etchings and drawings that people had made of him. And the Catholic Church, in an attempt to reconcile, you know,
centuries of ignorance,
Catholic faith with scientific inquiry, decided to make a big thing out of it, rebury him as a hero, and so on and so forth. And I thought that was interesting. I thought it was interesting that the Catholic Church is trying to sort of shove off the whole "we're against science" thing, and they've been doing that for quite a long time. I mean, as early as 12 or 15 years ago, they denounced the Catholic Church's estimation of Galileo as a heretic. And actually, quite a long time ago, almost 200 years ago, Copernicus's heliocentrism book was removed from the banned books of the Catholic Church.
One of the good things about dealing with fiction is you can rewrite it any time to suit whatever you want. So, although I'm kind of, I don't know, part of me is, as the atheist and all that, I mean, how important is this in a way if they had found his real bones? I mean, you'd say, oh, they did this facial reconstruction and they found a hair in a book, which they think is his hair. So this matches up. But I mean, even if it wasn't his bones, I mean, I guess the big thing is the symbology involved in here.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's interesting for Copernican scholars. Actually, I was reading a quotation from a Copernican scholar that went to the funeral just to see, like, oh, well, he quipped that he had missed the first funeral in the 1500s and thought it would be a good idea to go to the second time round. And it's just, like, they made such a big deal out of this as a sort of, like, gesture of apology to the scientific community. And just like, well, it's going to take a little more than that, you know?
Maybe they could, like, apologize for some of the other things that they've been doing in the last 50 years as opposed to, like, 400 years ago.
Or just stop doing...
Yeah, stop it in general. It'd be nice to science. That'd be great, too.
I just think that the other thing is that a lot of the media thought that, you know, he had been buried because the Catholic Church had deemed him a heretic. And that's not true. He was deemed because that was the way the church did things at that time, at that place. And I just thought that was interesting, that there's this sort of mismatch between what people thought was the case and what actually turned out to be the case.
So history is not as solid as we think it is.
No, I mean, like, people in Poland who are very, very Catholic, you know, it pervades everything in Polish life. I've been to the Copernicus Museum. He's highly respected among the people in Poland and in that area. So it's not like they all thought he was a, you know, jerk for showing that Earth wasn't at the center of the universe.
How dare you move the sun?
Right. Well, that's pretty great for him. I'm sure that if he was alive today, he'd appreciate the gesture.
Yeah. He's spinning around the sun in his grave.
In a grand scheme of things. Yeah. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with more about the sun, no less.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
Hey, this is Jules.
And this is Kim.
And we're the Presets. You're listening to CITR on
101.9. That was
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we were talking about Copernicus and revolving around the sun. Now we're going to talk about sunscreen. And is it bad for you?
From the sun to copper tone.
No,
I blew it. We were talking
Copernicus
about this before the show.
To copper tone.
There we go.
Seriously, we need to work on these segues, guys. Anyways.
Well, it seems like every week, or maybe even closer to every day, I noticed the media blowing out of proportion some scientific study about cancer being correlated with something. Or in this case, it's not even a scientific study, it's a report by an environmental group. And I always want to look at these to see if there's actually truth behind them, because often they are highly misleading. I'll just give you a bit of an idea. Here's the Huffington Post title for this story. Sunscreens with vitamin A may accelerate skin cancer. FDA knows danger, doesn't report. And
those fiends.
Not only is it sort of misleading science, but it's like a conspiracy thrown in there too.
Well, the Huffington Post is really a well thought out, well logic and reasoned source of scientific news and expertise, is it
featuring,
not?
Featuring blogging by Deepak Chopra.
And Jenny McCarthy. That website's great. Don't go to it. but I decided to look into this claim. I also saw it in many other news outlets, like CTV News. I looked at the original report, which was by the Environmental Working Group, and it was called... One sec.
The Environmental Working Group title thing.
Yeah, whatever. Who cares about the title? We'll link it on the show notes. But anyways, basically in there, they looked at 500 different sunscreens and in the end only recommended 8% of them, saying that a lot of them caused danger to you and were more harmful than beneficial. So
how exactly do they cause danger to you?
Well, they had tons of different reasons, and I'm not going to go into all of them, but one of the most shocking ones was that they say that vitamin A actually increases your risk, or increases how fast skin tumors grow. And vitamin A is in about 40% of sunscreens on the market. So I decided to look into this, and I couldn't find any scientific articles actually saying anything like this. I found a couple small ones from like the 70s studying this in mice with like small correlations, but it seemed a bit weird that if they were studying that in the 70s, it's just suddenly coming out now if there was actually any problem. And I couldn't find any like large meta-analysis finding any relationship here. And I mean, even that report says, the evidence against vitamin A is far from conclusive, but as long as it is suspect, EWG recommends that consumers choose vitamin A-free sunscreens.
You know, going with the logic of why they put vitamin A, from what I understand from the little research that I did beforehand, is they put vitamin A in sunscreen in order to revitalize aging skin. I guess the idea is, and this goes along with the tumor thing, is that it helps promote the growth of new cells in your skin. If you're older and your skin cells aren't replacing properly, vitamin A is supposed to help. And if that's true for regular skin cells, it would be logical that it would be the same for tumor cells, quote unquote, although again, I couldn't find any scientific evidence for this, but if you ever read a bottle of suntan lotion that says vitamin A in there, they say anti-aging formula or something like that. Mm-hmm. So as far as the rationale goes, it's consistent, even enough, none of it seems very scientific.
Yeah. The bottom line is there's no good reason to be afraid of vitamin A right now. If it's in your sunscreen bottle, you know, keep using it.
Just to take a sort of consumer advocate point of view here, there's a different reason to avoid a lot of sunscreens, and that's just that most of them are more powerful than they need to be. From what I understand, anything above SPF 30 really isn't worth the extra cost.
Exactly. When I was looking at the report, they did bring this up, and this is a completely fair assessment of this sunscreen industry. They've started throwing on huge numbers next to the SPF, like SPF 100. For people who don't know, SPF, basically, what it's saying is that your skin will, if it's SPF 30, it'll take 30 times as long in the sun to burn than if you didn't wear it, if you put it on properly. And there is the biggest problem. Almost no one seems to put enough sunscreen on when they do. So even SPF 100 sunscreen goes down to about 5 because people don't put enough on. So what they found is that people throw on a little bit of SPF 100 and think they're perfectly safe for the day, when in reality, a lot of harmful radiation is getting through.
Okay, now you've confused me here. So Rob just said that they make suntan lotions out there way stronger than they need to be. Now you're telling me that even though it's really, really strong, because people misapply it, you only get maybe 1/10 of the coverage. So maybe these super strong lotions are really good because nobody seems to know how to apply them properly. So you're only going to get 1/4 of the protection anyhow.
The way it works out is that when not applied correctly, SPF 30 isn't that much different than SPF 100. But psychologically, you think you're better protected.
If applied properly.
If applied improperly, there's almost no difference in the amount of protection. If applied properly, there is, but I mean, 30 times the protection of your, like, just skin alone is more than most people are going to need.
I'm sure people who work in nuclear power plants love the SPF 100, just as that extra layer of protection.
Well, I've always noticed that sunscreen seems to attract bugs. And since it attracts mosquitoes, and mosquitoes carry malaria, de facto, then, isn't sunscreen potentially going to increase your risk of getting malaria?
Does it actually attract bugs, or do they just stick to it?
I don't know. If you run really fast, they, like, slam into you and stick to you.
That's why you combine sunscreen with bug repellent.
Right.
Extra chemicals on your...
Actually, another thing I noticed, too, that may be a much bigger issue with this, and we haven't done enough research to say one way or another, but not all sunblockers are the same. Some of them use powdered chemicals like zinc oxides. Some of these organic compounds, I think oxyotone or something, I'm mispronouncing that. But those chemicals in themselves can actually have a far greater effect on any ill effects you can have than this vitamin A does, because although vitamin A is, it's a natural occurring vitamin, it's something you have normally, these other ones, not that I'm saying they're bad, but I mean, if you were going to start pointing sticks at anything, at least that seems to be a far more rational basis to start from.
Maybe, but none of the commonly used ingredients seem to have any large ill effects, especially nothing that is worse than skin cancer, which wearing the right kind of sunscreen will protect.
Which goes back to a lot of these, you know, conspiracy or fear-mongering type things, is, you know, they're expecting a perfect solution. And even if we assumed that this was true, I was looking at the stats that they had on one of the web pages about the increase, and although there was a small increase in the growth rate, one, you had to have the tumor to begin with in order to promote, and two, you wouldn't have had the tumor at all if you had the suntan lotion at all, because you wouldn't have got skin cancer in the first place, or at least, you know, I mean, there are varying degrees of risk.
The media loves cancer stories. There was actually, as I recall, very recently, a parody or something, or a report or a survey of the Daily Mail, which is this ultra-biased conservative newspaper in the UK, that made fun of how often it had headline stories about something either preventing or causing cancer. And they found that there was actually a lot of overlap in the stories, that things would both prevent and cause cancer, and that there was almost anything you can imagine was slotted into either one or the other category. And when you actually went and looked at the studies, results were minimal to inconclusive.
I've found over many years of looking at these, it's best to just ignore the studies when they come out and on the news. If they tell you, I don't know, antioxidants in your green tea are probably going to, stop you from getting cancer, don't start drinking green tea just for that. It's probably not going to. And there's probably going to be some other effect they find 5 years where maybe it causes some kind. It's all kind of silly.
And there's also another, to be more sinister, aspect to this. I was listening to an Australian program called Media Watch, which I highly recommend anyone to listen to. And they were talking about one of their newspapers that had something up to 35% of its content was product-driven, as in there was no actual news in it. It was just intended to promote a product. And I'm wondering how many of these, green tea helps cure cancer, how much of that might somehow be related to that. Not starting a conspiracy theory, just throwing it out there.
Maybe, but I don't know if there's enough concentration in the green tea market do that.
I'm sure they want to cash in on any kind of popularity. Green tea, I don't know if it's still super popular, but about 5 years ago, it was the thing to have. Everybody drank green tea, and it was just oh, this is so trendy, it's so cool.
The antioxidants just stopped every disease.
Exactly, and I think that, newspapers, they want to get eyes, and if they can't get, ads, the next best thing is to just say what everybody else, wants them to say and just say it.
Well, and you also get the echo chamber effect. I mean, if this article appeared on one website or one paper, it's easier for me to copy that and put that on my own because, one, hey, it must be popular. They put it on there. Two, it's cheaper for me to copy and paste than to actually write. So, I mean, you start getting the same article showing up in five or six different places, but it's really kind of all the same thing.
So I guess what we're saying is buy SPF 30 sunscreen if you need it and wear it properly.
Exactly. Well, Daniel can create a demonstration of how to apply sunscreen properly.
Yeah, YouTube will be up with Daniel applying suntan lotion in the correct...
No. I'm sure that's on there with much more attractive people than
Well, why don't we talk about the main story, the thing that's on everybody's mind right now, and that is the quote-unquote breakthrough of creating artificial life. But is it a game-changing breakthrough?
You're not talking about World of Warcraft or anything when you say artificial life. I mean, when you say artificial life, what are you talking about, Ethan?
Well, I'm talking about one Dr. Greg Venter, who has created what is quoted as an artificial life form by sequencing the genetic code of a bacterium artificially and then inserting it into a bacteria in which that bacteria then reforms itself and multiplies. That is the artificial life that's been floating around out there. And I want to get everyone's thoughts on this. I want to know, is this really a breakthrough? Is this really artificial life?
Well, first of all, I was online the morning that this was announced, and I just thought it was really cool how I had Twitter and RSS feeds open, and all of a sudden, blong, 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 blong. It was everywhere. Every outlet was picking it up. People were going crazy on Twitter. It was filling up the screen on RSS reader. And I read through a whole bunch of these stories. And I just thought it was clearly the internet thinks it's a breakthrough or that it's newsworthy. That
right.
The J. Craig Venter Institute and his team, they sequenced a DNA from scratch, from four test tubes in the lab, and created something that replicates.
Actually, that's not... From my understanding, is that one of the big problems they had in creating this this DNA molecule chain, because it was so long, relatively speaking, is that it was very, very fragile and very hard to actually create. So they started it off with a small snippet to begin with, and they actually used yeast cells to continue to build it. So it wasn't they had a little dot matrix printer with gene material in it.
Well,
and that
I mean,
built
like,
up. Don't get me wrong. Everyone is commending him hugely on the technical achievement. But again, part of me says, one, which we haven't talked about already, the actual gene that he had to create, the actual DNA pattern, was off of an existing life form. I forget the exact name of it, but it was an existing one.
Right. I believe it was a bacterium that causes some sort of disease in goats.
Okay. Goats are probably really happy that we've created an artificial form of that, quote unquote. The other thing is, too, is, I mean, again, he's using yeast largely to do the recombination, to actually make it grow into huge factors.
Though I think he called them synthesis machines or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. That's what I have here. To sort of summarize for listeners who maybe aren't quite up to speed on this, what Dr. Venter did is he created, like, I guess electronically, he documented what the genetic code should be. He created it using these quote-unquote synthesis machines, whatever those are, and then he inserted it into a bacterium. And he took the DNA code out of that bacterium. The new code went in. The bacterium reformed itself so that it matched the genetic blueprint it had and started replicating, which is exactly sort of the benchmark for how something is alive. So the question is this artificial? Well, first of all, the cell itself was not artificial. It was a natural cell. It was organic. All the pieces of it, the, I don't know what you call the little working parts of it, are all really organic. Again, what Don just mentioned, he didn't make up DNA. He copied it from an existing bacterium and inserted it in there. So,
he added a few of his own additions, as I recall. I know that at the very least, he put in 4 DNA sequences that acted as watermarks, so that if it ever escaped the lab, people would be able to sequence it and determine its provenance.
I thought it was funny, too, and I have no idea how he did this, but he said somewhere encoded into it is a website. And if anyone can find this website and send him an email, he'll buy them coffee or something.
That a joke? Or
no, this is... I was listening to, what was it, Quirks and Quarks, and they had an interview with, I think it was him, and he said that he put in a web URL. I mean, I imagine it's like www.1.
That is awesome.
This guy's getting too much funding.
That's actually the other thing. The one thing to note this guy is very famous for is that he was the one who was in race with the government-funded genome project to create the human genome.
This guy is like, he's sort of presented as the bad boy of genomic science. Like
he wears a leather jacket in the lab.
Like he'll talk shit about people and like, you know, be on the media, make a lot of claims and sort of be like racing with the Human Genome Project and stuff like that. And basically, like, he's doing what he wants to do it, how he wants to do it.
And to be fair to him too, I mean, he was using a pre-existing genome to create this. And one of the reasons why he said he did this is that, well, we were testing the technology of making DNA molecules. We weren't actually testing, can we make life from scratch? So we wanted to have something that we know would have worked once we had made it. So we used that just to eliminate one of the confounding factors, because they could have created one from quote-unquote scratch with nothing on there, and it wasn't viable as a life form. So they knew this would have at least worked. One of the things that struck me as bizarre, and he said this in every interview I listened to, and I heard him on about 4 different shows, he was really making the rounds, is he kept saying that, one, the computer was its mother, and that he booted up the cell. And he kept using these computer technology terms. And part of that, I'm wondering if it was going into the whole ethics of it. He was trying to get away, use the word synthesis machines. And in one interview, he referred to them as yeast cells. That got him around one of the technical difficulties. But I don't know. Again, as a technical achievement, great. I think the next experiment, and he says what he's trying to do, is he's going to pare down this genome to you have just a very basic part so that all it does is reproduce. Once you have that, then you can add in your new stuff to make vaccines, to make oil-eating bacteria, what have you. So...
nano machines, that'd be cool.
That's the other side of this. They're kind of saying how this is artificial life and it's going to lead to all these breakthroughs. But the potential for it to lead to breakthroughs does not make it all that more exciting. I mean, anything could potentially lead to breakthroughs if it pans out, if this scales up. He started with a bacterium. If he moves on to, you know, building a small goat or something... Okay, that's pretty darn cool. But
I think it's pretty darn cool that he made a bacteria.
Well, he's saying this is going to lead to new fuels, better way to clean polluted water, and faster vaccine production. Okay, but how?
It almost seems to me like the possibilities for this are limitless. It's almost like the first time someone made a microprocessor. It started off tiny, unable to do much, but there's so much potential there that it's insane.
This is proof of concept. If you can sequence DNA, even if it's existing DNA, and use a blueprint to build it, but sequence it from scratch, then you can do a whole lot of other things using the same method.
Well, that actually leads to another criticism. People said, again, that this is not necessarily that big of a thing, is that the things that he wants to do with it, we can already do by genetically modifying existing bacteria. So instead of creating the bacteria from scratch, we just use that yeast cell and insert into its genome whatever thing we wanted to make it do. That this, some people have said, is a just overly complex way of doing something that we can already kind of do now, much simpler, just by genetic modification.
So let's just take a quick poll here. Who says this is artificial life? Don?
I guess I have to say, yeah, it's artificial life. It is. It's okay. Barely, but it qualifies.
Like, this really comes down to how you want to define artificial life. Like, if you define life as something that replicates and artificial as something that was synthetically created, then, yeah, I'm going to say it's artificial life.
Yeah, definitely life. I started with the artificial part, yes, because so little, I mean, he sort of inserted something that was already made by nature, quote unquote, into it, but I'd say it probably just counts as artificial.
Another thing that he was pointing out, and this maybe goes to what Ethan's question, is he's saying that this bacteria that he made cannot trace its linear heritage back to anything except to the computer. And I mean, granted, the particular example he's used, this case, I don't think that's true, because, I mean, he was copying an existing genetic line. I think that's the thing. The next generation is going to be the kicker, the one that's actually going to be truly a natural selection life.
That's actually kind of interesting, because as it is now, like, every life form almost for sure has an ancestor, a common ancestor. So this was... mean that that's not true anymore.
Actually, the more interesting thing I think that can really make this cool, and Ethan was talking about goats, is one of the things all life on Earth, you know, is basically limited to what has come before it. I mean, all humans, all animals have two legs, two arms, a tail, and a head. It's sort of a body plan that early along in evolution we got stuck with, and because we're along that path, we can't shift trains. Well, now this makes it possible for us to really just rewrite the whole thing from scratch if we wanted to, if we have that morality.
Exactly. Well, why don't we take a one last quick commercial break on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle. Let the clatter kill him. Let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition's Bike to Work Week from May 31st to June 6th. Join thousands of others cycling and celebrating. Bike to Work Week encourages people to try biking to work and celebrates with those that already do. During the week, visit commuter stations to enjoy free food, drinks, bike maps, bike maintenance, and fabulous prizes. You can win a new bike for recruiting the most coworkers to join your team, or for recording your commute online. There's a bike a day giveaway just for logging your commute. To register and track your progress online, visit biketoworkmetrovan.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So let's discuss if this is actually dangerous? That's the other big question floating around. Has Dr. Venter created Frankenstein that's going to devour us or infect us or kill us or something?
Or the new nuclear bomb?
Exactly.
To start this off on a positive note, I was mentioning before that a number of people have said, well, you know, you can do the same sort of thing now just by modifying existing organisms out there. And actually, a very interesting thing that had happened before was Australia, in an attempt to control its mice population, was manipulating a particular virus, a mousepox virus, in order to make them sterile. Inadvertently, they had made a mistake, and they didn't know they had made a mistake, and they created something that attacked the immune system that was 100% lethal, killed all the time, very, very virulent, and they were lucky. I mean, they kept it in the lab, but I mean, it was one of those things that they had created this artificial life, although it was just modified life, but they had no idea what the actual outcome was going to be, or the possible outcome, and they created this really horrible thing. Is that something that we should worry about with this particular technology?
I think the notion that this is simply too dangerous to pursue is a bit misguided. I think potentially this technology could be used to create biological weapons or something, but the key word here is potentially, which does not mean likely.
Not only that, but existing technology makes biological weapons much easier. I mean, right now on edge.org, people are discussing the implications of this work, and a lot of really interesting people are discussing whether it poses dangers or not. You should go on there and look at it. But P.Z. Myers, aka Pharyngula, has actually mentioned this exact thing that people are saying that it's dangerous and that it's going to kill everyone and the biological weaponry, blah blah blah. But existing tech already lets you do that in a much easier way. But on the flip side, Daniel Dennett, a noted philosopher and cognitive scientist, has a sort of another idea of like, well, we should regulate to make sure that it's safe and that make sure people can't abuse it.
I remember actually an interesting parallel that we might go into a bit more deeply later is with nuclear power, nuclear energy. And I'm reading science fiction in the 50s. You know, nuclear power was going to solve all the world's problems. And at the same time, you had duck and cover. You know, it was also going to end the entire world. I mean, I wonder if we can make any analogies to nuclear power in regards to this technology.
I think it's pretty easy to make that analogy. You know, the thing with nuclear weapons is you kind of have this, I think, cultural idea that some sort of James Bond-esque villain is going to get this and unleash it on the world. And I think that, you know, with nuclear weapons, translates really well to this. I mean, first of all, they're both really rare, speaking, you know, in terms, I'm not going to get my hands on nuclear weapons, I'm not going to get my hands on this technology anytime soon. It's going to be isolated to, you know, very high-tech labs and secure locations around the world, right? They're hard to make. I can't make a nuclear bomb from scratch very easily without plutonium. And I'm probably not going to be able to make a cell from scratch or recreate this guy's experiment by reading it on the internet. The level of knowledge and the raw materials needed, I think, surpasses what's available to the average person and also, you know, the average villain. You know, unless you're, again, a James Bond-esque villain with millions of dollars and a high-tech base and, you know, a hot sidekick, you're not going to get this kind of stuff. And the other thing that I think is really interesting to point out is that there are several very powerful, influential forces in the world that police nuclear weapons, whether it's like the UN or the United States, and they also police things like this, biological things. They're policed by you know, scientific academia, and they're also policed by, you know, various rights advocacies and, you know, responsible science advocacies.
Scientists don't necessarily want government agencies mucking about with their work. There was a recent article in The Scientist, I believe, where the cover article was about how the FBI had approached numerous biological researchers and asked them to sort of share all of their data with them and like to basically let them look at it and make sure that it was secure and that nobody could use it for bioweaponry. Mm-hmm. And it's basically they were interfering with the way that the scientists were doing their research and sort of directing it in a certain way so that any potential military applications from the research would be funneled towards that particular organization, in this case, the United States. So there's things to be said about, you know, agencies not overseeing too much about the way the research is done, but certainly for the outcomes of the research and the industrial applications of it.
I think one of the things, too, it's almost impossible to look into the future, right? I mean, you sit there and you say, well, you know, it's really hard technology to get a hold of. Unlike nuclear weapons, though, I mean, this is all stuff that you could, in theory, have in your house. I mean, biological material exists. You might find in the back of Scientific America the DNA 2000 and prints and creates life just for you in that. But I mean, the point is, I mean, right now it's future tech, and who knows what's going to happen in the future. But now is the time when we should start thinking about these ethical implications, right? We shouldn't sit there and say, well, let's create it and then see what happens. It's now created, so we've got that first step. We know it's a possibility, unlike something that we don't know is going to happen. And how should we deal with this? I mean, Rob just said we shouldn't really have too much government interference. Ethan, I think, wouldn't mind interference. I love regulation.
I wish he wasn't going to talk about that, but I'll talk about that. When you bring up that the U.S. acts as sort of a police on it, I'd point out that they're the only ones to use it. So, I don't know. The U.S., I wouldn't say really polices the use of it. They just police the use of it by people they don't want to use it.
When you say use, you mean nuclear weapons.
Yeah, for nuclear weapons, what I'm saying, it probably would transcend to this. The U.S. is probably, if they have access to it, will probably look for ways to weaponize it before other people do.
Right.
I mean, they might be a little more rational than a crazy person, but also a crazy person probably isn't going to have access.
But I mean, note here that weaponizing it is just one more application of the tech. The tech isn't necessarily good or bad. Any science, any advance in technology or methodology is value neutral. It's how people use it that counts.
And one of the great examples of that was alternating current. If anyone, I was watching a documentary between Westinghouse and Edison. You know, one was for direct current and one was alternating.
So let's Edison, not forget Tesla.
Yeah, and Edison was going around the country electrocuting as many animals as he could get a hold of to show how dangerous. And in fact, he was the one who promoted the electric chair as a means of execution to show how dangerous alternating current was. So, I mean, electricity isn't inherently a bad thing, but it can be turned to bad purposes.
It hurts people too.
Yeah, it actually hurts people more. And note that AC won out in the end.
Well, the other thing too with dealing with sort of like what a rational person will do, let's not forget that nuclear weapons aren't new. It wasn't so long ago that we had the Cold War. And, I mean, you can say what you will about the United States policing the world that's not exactly great, or, you know, the Soviet Union having all these nuclear weapons. It's not great. But they didn't go to a nuclear war. One of the reasons was because no one really wants to destroy the planet. You may want to control the planet.
Mutually assured destruction.
You may want the planet for yourself, but you're not going to wipe it out. And I think the same with biological weapons. You may want to control it. You may want to have dominion over it. But if you wipe out all life, that's kind of going to suck. So a rational person, a rational thinking person, is probably not going to jump to that. Now, again,
unfortunately, people tend not to be rational thinking people if they want to destroy things.
The non-rational thinking people tend not to fund science, though. So that's my caveat to that one. You don't see too many like radical, you know, religious zealots going, let's fund more stem cell research. You know, most of them just want to wind back the clock to like, you know, turning butter.
Two words, 12th Monkey.
A really horrible movie?
Yeah, but
I beg to differ.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, so unfortunately, that's so bad. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights.
I got one, actually. It was a recommendation to me. I haven't actually read it yet, but Philip Pullman has a book out. What's the name of it? The Good Guy Jesus. There it is. The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, which is apparently taking the view that let's pretend Jesus was one person and Christ was another person, and they interacted in Middle East at the time. And anyhow, Philip Pullman, for people who don't know, is sort of the anti-C.S. Lewis, famous for his Dark Material, among other things. Anyhow, someone said this was a good book to read, so I'm going to take a look at it.
Is it fiction?
Yes, it's fiction.
And if you
it
can,
to be, it's about Jesus.
Right.
Look up a press conference or something that he was giving to promote the book, where a person in the audience self-identifies as a Christian and asks him about the offense that the title of the book could cause to people. And Pullman takes him down with a great quote-worthy speech about how no one has the right to not be offended. For my little highlight of this week, for those of you who don't know, Science World is currently undergoing a $35 million renovation, and they want to consult with the public about what they should do. And if you want to show your support for Science World and tell Vancouver that you care about science and science outreach, go to their first public consultation, which is tomorrow, Wednesday, at 4 to 8 p.m. at Science World.
And I'd just like to recommend an awesome podcast called Econ Talk. Don't let the econ part in it scare you away. It's interesting. Topical issues as well. I'd highly recommend listening to that. Excellent. As well as continuing listening to us.
Yeah, well, we're the best. I have a CFI lecture I want to remind people about. It's called A Primer on Asshole Skepticism, and it's Friday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center in the Canford Policy Room. Our own good pal, Kennedy Goodkey, will be giving a talk entitled I May Be a Jerk, But At Least I'm Right. Now Who's the Asshole? So check that out. It's going to be lots of fun.
Oh, wait, I just remembered. We forgot something. If anyone out there wants to send us their comments or any ideas or any comments about the show, how could they possibly do that?
Well, they can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, or they can leave a comment on our blog at radiofreethinker.com.
And what if they wanted to promote us to their friends and family and all that? What should they do then?
Dig us.
Or you can become a fan of us on Facebook. And another good option is, if you like our podcast, subscribe to it on iTunes and leave a favorable review, because those things help people. They really do. That's pretty much it for Radio Free Thinker this week. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying, do you know where your towel is?
This is Daniel saying, thanks for listening.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien